session number 9938, Reel 8.
What's Reel 8?
I was aiming at the stern, where the cables from the stern of the ship were tethered to the dock. And there's only one way, which is crawl along towards them and risk anybody seeing me. And I'm making good progress, and that's a very slow, comparatively slow call, when I could hear voices, and two guards were coming off duty, and I was on one side of the rails or railway line. It ran along there, and the guards came on the other side, I suppose 4 foot, 8, 9 and a half, or whatever it is, distance away. They were so glad to be coming off duty. They were talking eagerly with one another, and I just pressed my face into the dock. Fortunately, I got these gloves on. I got this this whole escape black equipment all over me, and I just laid absolutely still, thinking, "Oh God, this is it. There's nothing to do. Just obey them if they shout at you, but just stay still." And they walked past. Quite astonishing. They really missed it. And at that stage, I just swung out into the cables and shinned up a cable for the stern of the Aralis. I shinned up the wrong cable, because one was tethered to the outside of the rounded stern of the ship and some feet below the level of the railings and so on, and the place you can get in where the cable goes in. And I couldn't hang on to it at all. Nobody could, except some extraordinary athletic person with superhuman fingers. So I had to come back again, showing myself to the guards along the dock fence, if they were looking in that direction, once again, and grab the correct cable and shin up that, which by that time I was very tired, and I managed to do it. I remember I passed a porthole and rather insanely just knocked on it. I don't quite know why, just to say at any rate I knocked on the porthole of a Swedish ship. I didn't do that very long, and I slithered up through the cable hole in the ship, and pulling my feet up quickly, and just lay there panting on board my Swedish ship. Next great moment, complete silence, nobody had seen me. Marvelous, marvelous. And nevertheless, something had to be done, because those ships were examined. We knew that. So I didn't hide in a lifeboat, because that's corny, that everybody does, and any guard can find you in a lifeboat. So I went in to one of the, on the far side from the dock, to one of the little doors leading to a passageway to the cabins and so on. And I saw a lighted cabin. So I went in there and knocked on the door. And there was a steward in a white coat. And I said, I'd like to stay on this ship. I come aboard. I'd like to stay on the ship, and I'm escaped prisoner. I'm English and so on.
In English or German?
In German, I said this, in a stumbling sort of way, and he said in German. He said, you must leave this ship, in German. And it was only afterwards, when everything was over, that I discovered he stuttered all the time anyway. But it added to the tremendous tension of the moment. And then at that moment a sailor looked in, who had obviously seen and heard something going on, a sailor from SS Aralis. And he stood by the door. Everybody stood by the door except the steward, who stayed inside. And then an officer came and announced, "You must leave this ship. You must leave this ship. No, no, you can't stay on board. You can't stay on board." And then the captain came And yes, and he was a very slow-spoken fellow, certainly a captain. And I tried absolutely everything. I said, nobody's seen me. I can sand the ship, can't I? I won't give you any trouble, and I won't say you know that I'm on board or anything. He said, don't make any difference, you must leave this ship. And then I said, well, this is a sporting jet, so English are having a go at escape and so on and so forth. No, sporting gestures weren't for him. Surely he could stretch a point and so on. No, not for him. No, you must leave this ship. And so on and so on. And then I tried that Sweden is always so nice to people who are in trouble and so on. He said, yes, they're not too bad. And so that didn't get me anywhere. And then I tried the wife and children business. Family, and they don't want me shot or handed over these people. And, no, you're not terribly interested. And families always suffer in time of war and so on. And then I said, well, think of it from Sweden's point of view. I said, the English are now in Rome. The British are now in Rome, which is a damn lie. It took another month or two, actually. But it was sort of semi-verge of being taken as Alexander and people came up Italy. And he said, oh, no, he said, they won't win the war. And that, you can really go on arguments like this. And so I came out of the last card, which was my government will give you £200 if you take me to Sweden. And he said, nine, no interest at all. And I said, my government will guarantee to give you £500 if you take me to Sweden. And that was my limit. And he just shook his head once again and said, it is not worth my while to be hanged by the Gestapo for £500, he said. And then he just turned away. And there wasn't much else to do. One waited, because it would have taken him 30 seconds or a minute and a half, most 2 minutes, to go to the rail of that ship and call up the guard who was pacing bottom of the gangway with his rifle and just have me marched off. But he didn't do it. And a few minutes went into 5 minutes and so on. And so I said to the steward man there, well, I'll go and hide myself now. You haven't seen me. Forget all this. And as I went out, there was an officer who was on the deck there, and he just pointed, didn't say anything, towards what turned out to be the coal, and ladder down to where the coal was. And I realized at last I had a friend. I certainly need a friend. And I tried lying in the coal, which is a very difficult thing. Great lumps of coal, and you can put lumps of coal over your body for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, by which time it's absolute agony, it presses in, and I was going to have to stay there from Sunday night till Tuesday morning. And I found this very unsatisfactory. And in addition, I knew they used dogs, and obviously, for obvious reasons, the dogs would be able to smell you if you been lying down there for a large number of hours. They soon sniff you out. A little seaman came down. It later turned out to be Jon Jørgensen.
Jon Jørgensen?
Johansson. And I said, no good. No good. Coal, no good. And then he said, waved his finger at me, and he then guided me, and we went down to the very bottom of the ship, and he unscrewed a great tool, an oval plate, and opened it up, and there was a dank tank down there at the very bottom of the ship, which had an oily smell. And then we had an agonizing talk about luft, air, breathe. And eventually I got it home to him that I was asking, can you breathe if you have me down there and you screw me up? Because it's a wonderful place to hide. And it all dawned on him that that's what I was after, and we agreed luft, air, okay. And he screwed me down there, and that was a magnificent hiding place. Magnificent hiding place. Oily, and you crouched there, and fairly beastly, but it is very good. And during that time, I heard a cling, 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 much later than this conversation I've recounted here. I heard a cling, cling of the engine room telegraph, and then that little shaking motion that a ship does when it's getting underway, and I knew we were leaving Danzig, and I knew the search, which would inevitably have taken place, of Germans with dogs was over, and we were heading towards Sweden. And I remember sitting on my hands. It was very cold and horrible down there, but I was sitting on my hands because of the cold and bending my head down because it was cramped and so on, saying, God, I made it, like a lunatic. And that was the next stage of having done it. It was going well. And in fact, it looked like the final thing. And it wasn't until we were going right up the Swedish coast, very close in, when he let me out of this, little Johansson let me out. And I clambered out, and he said, we see captain now. So I wondered about that. And he led me up, and there was the captain on his bridge. And there was Sweden slipping by there. Trees just close. And these captains had on occasion returned escapers. They just turned their ships around and taken them straight back to Danzig or Stettin or wherever they come from and handed them over to the Gestapo. And I knew that it happened sometimes. So my immediate question was, well sir, I hope it is okay. I can stay here. I'm sorry about last night. And so on, if I was embarrassing to you, and so on, so on. And of course, he always took an age to talk, and he slowly said, yes, you were not very welcome last night, but it is all right now. You'll take me to Sweden. Yes, he said, yes. And so I breathed again. I was entertained on the Aralys marvelously by the engineer officer and given a good old clean up because I covered with oil and coal dust and foul sight. And cleaned up. We went to Södertälje, just near Stockholm there, and docked. And then, with apologies, they said to me, well, you've got to be arrested now. And so, two Swedish policemen came on. We said goodbye, and I said thank you very much, and they locked me in a cell, very politely and with profuse apologies, and in the morning, they gave me breakfast outside the cell, which I thought was very civilized, and said you're going along to interview authorities now, and okay. They said, who are you, and so on. I was very frank. I said where we come from, and so on. I did not say how I'd escaped, but I said what prison camp I escaped from, and so on. And they asked me a lot of questions and so on, which I said, I can't answer, because the general theory, which I think is so, that the Nazi organization had probed into had probed into all the Swedish authorities and so on, and planted agents wherever they could, and so they asked all of these questions, but then they gave up, and I said, I'm a free man, am I? And they said, yes, and we do more than that, we'll get you a taxi. And so I was put into a taxi, and of course one went through a sort of Alice in Wonderland place, Stockholm, with Christmas coming on, with orange, all lit up, no blackout, you see, with oranges and food and fruit of all type, and Christmas goodies, of toys for children, everything of peacetime, like Aladdin's cave. And I sat in the taxi, wafting through this glorious place. And then it eased out to the, more or less towards the outskirts a bit. And there, needless to say, was the British legation. Great, huge building there. And I never discovered who paid the taxi or what happened. I walked out of this in a sort of daze. And walked up, and there was that brass plate saying British Legation. I just didn't believe it, and I stood there staring at this in a stupid sort of way, to the extent that various other people coming in and out sort of began muttering, I think. And I walked in, and they gave me, I said, I want to report here. And I'm from I was the British Air Attaché, and I'm reporting, and would you sign this book, and so on. So I signed my name, and put down RAF, where from, Germany. And of course that was taken up to appropriate office. So immediate reaction. I was taken up and saw Group Captain Maycock, who was a soul of friendliness, and sat me down, and tea and some cakes and so on, all the rest of it. It is nice to see you. What a trip you must have had, and so on. You come from Stalingrad 3? Oh, yes, we never had, amazing. And congratulations, all the rest of it. And then he asked me the name of my commanding officer, and I said, Wing Commander Favell. And he said, how long had Wing Commander Favell been in charge of 43 Squadron? I said, no, sir, 42 Squadron. And there are various other little traps like that in case I was lying and was uncertain of my story. And quite clever traps, quite a few of them. And in the end, he clearly accepted me as not being a phony. Everything was laid on. And somebody took me out to dinner, and it was very wonderful. And very good. It is some days later that... Having been put up, which I thought a little pointed perhaps, in a teetotal hotel called the Excelsior, which nevertheless a nice enough hotel. It is many days later that the phone rang, and Sutton Pratt, the military attaché who sort of looked after escape really in Stockholm, he announced who he was and so on, said, you better come down, there's some friends of yours here. And he said, well, I can't talk on the phone. He couldn't talk on the phone in Stockholm at all. But you better come down. So I jumped into a taxi, and Sutton Pratt went up to the British Legation up to Sutton Pratt's office, and he made a bit of an occasion of it. I knocked on the door and opened the door, and he stood up and he said, "I think you've met before." And there, sitting opposite, sitting over there, looking, I thought, very coal bunkerish, because I was in a marvellous suit by then, and I was really respectable, shaved and everything, clean shirts and everything, looking very coal bunkerish, was Eric Williams. And all he could do was to grin, and he'd just arrived. And then the door opened a little further, and sitting on the edge of a chair there, looking as if he'd plan the escape, do the escape all over again, was Michael Codner, looking eager. And all he said was, he held out his hand, that he said, he looked coal bunkerish too, he said, "Ollie, where did you get that suit?" And this was the joining up, the end of the stolen journey trip to Stockholm. They then flew us back in turn. In my case, because I was first, I went out by a mosquito, which used to fly out of Stockholm by going up to 20,000 feet, which is high in those days, and I was in the diplomatic bags were hanging where the bombs normally and mosquito would hang, and I was up in the nose of this thing. And then screeching out over the sea north of Denmark, avoiding fighters. Sometimes the British Overseas Airways, which ran this air service during the war, which isn't generally known, even today I think, sometimes they were shot down, but this chap wasn't, and he screeched across the North Sea, dumped me down about 2 years after I'd left it at Lucas Aerodrome. Same old aerodrome. And I saw shapes of aircraft, but they weren't Beauforts anymore. They were the Beaufort Suns, as they were, Beaufort fighters, and sundry other aircraft in the black gloom. And I went to the operations room, and it was the same operations room at Lucas that we'd used, that I'd used when I'd shot down, before I'd shot down. And I noticed, I saw the board where I'd obviously been marked up as missing. It would have been overdue, then 1 hour overdue, and then missing, and then wiped off the board altogether. That's how it would have worked. And at that stage, a sergeant who was in charge of a lot to do with the operations room got up and came up to me and said, yes, he was there the time I was shot down. He hadn't been posted. And so one put a phone call through to home and so on, and that was Stolen Journey Wooden Horse.
You said that you were at both Spangenberg and Sagan. Do you find...
Sagan.
Yes.
S-A-G-A-N. Yes, Silesia.
Did you find much difference in morale between the RAF POWs and the Army POWs?
Well, without our wanting it in any way, all officer POWs were kept separate from all other ranks. And so one couldn't really answer that question. Our sergeant pilots, who did just the same as we did, even they were kept separate from us, and I suppose it was some sort of curious compliment to officers whom they'd captured. They probably seriously thought we'd mobilize the sergeants and attack the whole wire or something, and we were always kept separately. So I don't really know about morale in the other ranks camps, or still less the Army ones. The Army people I referred to in the 51st Highland Division were by definition of Spangenberg, were all officers.
But you could compare the Army officers with the RAF officers.
Oh, I see what you mean. Oh, no, just exactly the same, really. Just exactly the same. We've got to get out of this bloody place and chase up the Germans. Oh, yes, no doubt about it. They'd had some devastating experiences, the men some of the men who were in Spangenberg of the army from Crete, for instance, not Crete.
Saint Valery?
It
was Crete then, was it?
It was Crete, yes, it Crete. And the British army officers captured there were, well, one could casually say, unanimously of the belief that Crete could have held out. And it has yielded to the enemy prematurely because they thought, they were of the opinion, that the airborne Germans had expended their effort and there weren't any more ready, and so on. And they were very annoyed at Crete having been yielded to the Germans. The truth of that I haven't the faintest idea of, but that was their view. That's what they thought. But nevertheless, on your morale point of view, in spite of this very dismal experience they had, and our experience, which has been unfortunate sometimes, the morale, both Army and RAF, were exactly the same. Stand up to the Germans, to hell with them, and stand up to them in every known way, and escape whenever possible. There was a plan to get out of Spangenberg Castle and so on, delving into those deep ramparts, and some excellent army operations to that effect, the details of which I never knew, and I rather think everybody's moved from Spangenberg before they could operate it. But that's how it was.
At Saigon, do you remember a chap called Dixie Deans?
Oh, yes. I don't remember him at Saigon, but he's pretty well known among the the other parts of Stalag III, I'm not sure if he's Stalag III, but somewhere or other where sergeant pilots sergeants were. But I never came across him there. And since the war, of course, he had a tremendous, they say he was a tremendous leader amongst them of escapes of all types and attempted escapes and keeping on to morale, keeping morale up. He hadn't been very well. I'm not sure he's still alive. I hope he is.
Did your period of imprisonment leave you with any changed opinions about the Germans?
Where I got to on that was absolute fury with them for supporting the Hitler regime. But at the same time, a book I want to read, I haven't the faintest idea if it's a good book or not, but it's got a wonderful title, The Devilish Enchantment. And I saw Germans whom one would like to associate with, nice enough people, and so on and so forth. But then when they got to Hitler's salutes and attitudes towards the regime and so on, the gleam came in their eyes, and became absolutely, from flashes of time, so subhuman. And that is your fascism for you. It really was quite terrible. And the devilish enchantment, I could understand.